This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the very best arts and culture stories from NPR. I am Netta Ulabin, and you can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, how Hollywood made a hit out of a story about a call girl in a new book about Breakfast at Tiffany's. The original queen of vampire writers, Anne Rice, who's also known for her religious writing, on her decision to stop being a Christian. And a profile of rapper Biggie Smalls, a.k.a. the Notorious B.I.G., as part of our 50 Great Voices series. But first...
I've been through a lot lately. I've been shaken by earthquakes, pummeled by boulders the size of houses, chased by molten lava, smothered by ash clouds, battered by tidal waves, and that was all in one movie, 2012. Don't get me started on The Road or The Book of Eli. All of these cataclysms were perfectly persuasive. In fact, Hollywood's gotten so good at making them persuasive that disaster movies are almost always cited these days for their realism. So how come when a real disaster strikes, it feels so different?
In the Gulf of Mexico tonight, on this day, 95 of the oil spill crisis.
The most obvious disconnect? How long it takes. If the Gulf oil spill were a film, you'd have seen oil-covered polar bears within hours. Never mind that disasters mostly roll out slowly and with scattered effects. In films, they obey the classic Aristotelian unities. One big catastrophe taking place really quickly. No thousands of years for global warming to create an ice age. In the day after tomorrow, it takes 48 hours.
You're not gonna make it!
There are lots of other differences, of course. Disaster movies have characters. Real disasters have casualties. Disaster movies are exciting. Real disasters are agonizing. And things happen in a different order, something else you can blame on Aristotle. His rules for drama called for rising action leading to a climax. And across two millennia, we've gotten so used to that formula that we now see it in real life. Election cycles, sports tournaments, childbirth, Thanksgiving dinners, all have slow buildups to a climactic event. Disasters are disasters, in fact, because they don't follow that dramatic arc. Disasters happen, and then we have to deal with them, sometimes for decades. Disaster fiction won't work that way. If you start with your catastrophe, you've nowhere to go except cleanup. And where's the fun in that? So directors start by introducing victims we'd normally meet only after they've been dodging tidal waves or meteors or whatever, and putting warning signs everywhere. Temperature dials, radiation meters, whatever's appropriate to the coming apocalypse that can be ignored or misjudged or gazed at uncomprehendingly by the folks on screen.
Radiation containment.
Must be that safety valve just opened after the trip.
Somebody turn off the damned alarm.
This is what Alfred Hitchcock meant when he said suspense is the audience knowing something the characters don't.
We still have high radiation on level 8.
Perfectly normal.
In real life, nobody knows anything, so suspense isn't really the issue. Prior to 9/11, if you had asked most people what would happen if a jumbo jet crashed into a skyscraper, they'd have guessed the building would either stay standing or get knocked over sideways. The reality, now seared into a generation's consciousness, seems obvious after the fact.
One plane colliding with one twin tower, 18 minutes later, oh my God.
Even as it happened, you understood why it was happening, how each floor's collapse was putting more weight on the floor below.
Oh my God.
But the building's vertical fall wasn't what you expected, nor was that enormous cloud of ash that now shows up in all sorts of movies, but that no one had considered until we were all horrified by it in real life. And that points to the biggest difference between disaster cinematic and disaster authentic. In real life, catastrophes are just catastrophes. In films, something good almost always comes of them. A last-minute rescue, family unity, a disgraced scientist vindicated, some kind of light at the end of the tunnel. The movie doesn't have to show you how long the tunnel is. You see the light, the credits roll, and either the hero or whoever the hero was trying to save will be okay. And the next 30 or 50 or 100 years, that's left for the sequel that never gets made. I'm Bob Mandela.
Television viewers by the millions have followed the Real Housewives of Orange County and the Real Housewives of Atlanta, New Jersey, New York City, Now one of cable's most successful reality shows is moving to the nation's capital. It premieres on the Bravo channel this Thursday. NPR's Netta Ulaby wondered how her adopted hometown is presented in The Real Housewives of Washington, D.C.
It's actually one location, two places, Washington and D.C. Washington is the federal government, monuments, museums. It's the power elite of the city and the Maryland and Virginia suburbs.
God bless D.C. and its vanilla suburbs.
D.C. to Parliament Funkadelic is Chocolate City. It's taxation without representation. It's so-called mayor for life, Marion Barry. Even the Washingtonian magazine draws a distinction between Washington and D.C., says editor Alyssa Rosenberg.
If we're talking about Washington, it's the area as a whole. If we're talking about the district, it's D.C. proper.
Here's the one you'll see in The Real Housewives of Washington, D.C.
This city is filled with galas and events. It's important to know which ones to attend.
This town is small. Everybody has an agenda.
I asked anthropology professor Sabia Prince to look at the new season's first episode. She studies the cultural history of Washington and D.C.
These women are inhabiting, perhaps, to use that dichotomy, the world of Washington, more so than they are D.C.
Indeed. It's hard to imagine a sport less of D.C. than polo. But the first episode of The Real Housewives of Washington, D.C. features a polo match incongruously plopped right on the National Mall, one of the country's great public spaces. It was organized by America's most famous gatecrashers, Tariq and Michaela Salahi.
Salahi shoots!
One of the so-called housewives sees this match as worse than ridiculous. Her D.C.-based business had a bad experience with the event in the past.
It's not good for my business, and it's definitely not good for the city. I just have no desire to ever go back or be associated with that little goat rodeo.
The first season of any Real Housewives is about building relationships between women who are not necessarily friends in real life. Washington, D.C.'s black majority in this version is represented by one African-American, a district resident, and four white women who live in Maryland or Northern Virginia.
Girlfriend,
some unfortunate girlfriending and snapping of fingers from a housewife at a party who also brags about living near Dick Cheney in McLean, Virginia. She gets tipsy and corners two black guests to lecture them about a pressing social problem.
Salons need to integrate. We have different hair, different needs, but why do we have to be in a different salon?
The Real Housewives franchise purports to give its viewers a look at a place through one of its largely closed worlds, athletes' wives in Atlanta or a volatile New Jersey family. A story about white Washington suburbs versus a black urban D.C. is completely out of date, says anthropology professor Sabia Prince.
Washington is getting more diverse now. For so long, D.C. was about the dichotomy between black and white, and that's not even accurate anymore.
Prince describes Washington, D.C.'s culture as layered and complicated. She says maybe it's even big enough for party-crashing Virginians playing polo by the Washington Monument.
One group does not have a monopoly over this place that we call Washington, D.C. So I'm okay with highlighting bits and pieces of what else is going on. It's a part of the cultural dynamism of the place.
But the cultural dynamics of Washington, D.C., or the dynamics of the cast, was apparently not enough for series producers. They failed to get enough material for 13 episodes. The Real Housewives of Washington, D.C. has only 9, which, even for a cable show, is pretty short. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Anne Rice, author of the best-selling novel Interview with a Vampire and several more, last week made a splash with another piece of writing, this time on Facebook. Today, Rice wrote, "I quit being a Christian. I'm out. I remain committed to Christ, as always, but not to being Christian or to being part of Christianity." It wasn't the first time Rice went public about her religious views. She's written extensively about her Catholic upbringing, her atheism, and later her return to Catholicism and to God. Anne Rice joins us now from her home in Southern California to talk about her recent decision. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you wrote on Facebook that it's, quote, simply impossible to belong to a group that you describe as again, quoting here, quarrelsome, hostile, disputatious, and deservedly infamous. How difficult was it for you to sit down at a computer and actually write out those words?
It was very difficult. It was very painful. But I've always been public about my beliefs, and I've always been public about wanting to make a difference, and about the fact that my books reflect my beliefs. And frankly, after doing it, I felt sane for the first time in a very long while.
Hmm. So was this an impulsive act? Was there one thing or a series of things in particular that pushed you over the edge to say, I'm out?
There were certainly some last straws. But no, this is something that had been going on really almost from the beginning of my conversion in 1998. From the beginning, there were signs that the public face of Catholicism and the public face of Christianity were things that were, I found very, very difficult to accept. But I went along for a long time believing that it was okay. This would work out. The most important thing was devotion to God, devotion to Christ, embracing the orthodox truths of Christianity, that this is what really mattered. And over the years, as I continued to live as a Christian and study as a Christian and to pray as a Christian, more and more social issues began to impinge on me.
And I think I know what you might be talking about, but perhaps you could spell those out for us.
Well, I didn't anticipate in the beginning that the U.S. Catholic bishops were going to come out against same-sex marriage, that they were actually going to donate money to defeat the civil rights of homosexuals in the secular society. This is not something I ever foresaw. I certainly knew that the Catholic Church was not going to marry gay people or accept gay clergy or sanctify same-sex marriages, but that they would go into the secular culture to defeat same-sex marriage in Maine or in California, that was something that I simply had not foreseen. And when that broke in the news, I felt an intense pressure. And I am a person who grew up with the saying that all that is needed for evil to prevail is for good people to do nothing. And I believe that statement.
In the Christian faith, there are some, particularly in Catholicism, who say that doubt is actually an essential part of faith, to always be questioning and to engage in sort of a robust debate about what faith means. How much did you wrestle with that before you actually decided to leave? And did you think about actually staying within the church and fighting from inside instead of stepping outside of the actual church?
I did think about that, and there were times when I even publicly mentioned that. But I found that the kind of Christianity and Catholicism that was presented to me was one that did not invite debate and did not respect debate and did not want it.
Is there something that you'll miss about the ritual, communion?
Oh, I miss the Mass terribly. I miss very much going to the ritual. I miss the Eucharist. I miss taking communion. But Holy Communion is a communal meal, and I no longer belong in that community.
Your son, Christopher, is also a best-selling author, and he's also a gay rights activist. How instrumental was he in your decision? Was he top of mind as you were thinking about this?
Well, Christopher really wasn't instrumental in what I did ever. I mean, Christopher is a very tolerant person, and he accepted my return to Christianity and really never argued with me or opposed me in any way on it. So I can't say that that played a role. You know, I was known as a gay writer long before Christopher was born. Not long before, actually. He was born in 78, and I published Interview with the Vampire in 76. But from the beginning, I've had gay fans and gay readers who felt that my works involved a sustained gay allegory. I didn't set out to do that, but that was what they perceived. So even when Christopher was a little baby, I had gay readers and gay friends and knew gay people and lived in the Castro district of San Francisco, which was a gay neighborhood. And so my experience with gay people long preceded Christopher coming out of the closet and becoming a gay novelist.
Early on in your writing, particularly in writing the vampire novels, you said that those were written from an atheist point of view and that it would be difficult to write from that point of view once you return to Christianity and Catholicism in particular. Now that you've stepped away from the church, what does that mean for your writing? Does that mean that you might that readers might be seeing something different from you, that you might be returning to some of your early ideas or early themes?
Certainly, I will never go back to being that atheist and that pessimist that I was. I live now in a world that I feel God created, and I feel I live in a world where God witnesses everything that happens. People do not suffer and die without God seeing that and knowing about that, and that in God we have the hope of all answers and all explanations. That's a huge change from the atheist I was when I wrote the vampire novels. So I will not be returning to those metaphors or those stories. I completed my work there, and I'm interested in new themes, new characters, new stories now, and I think my work will continue to reflect the optimism.
Help me understand this, then. How did your return to Catholicism shape your writing, and how might this decision to step away, this repudiation, influence your work now?
I'm not sure that we have to differentiate here between a conversion to Christ and a belief in God and a conversion to organized religion. They're really very different. I'm not going to go back on my belief in God. I'm not going to go back on my faith in him. That's what changed for me in 1998. I found what the characters in the vampire novels were looking for. They were groping in the darkness. They lived in a world without God. I found God. But that doesn't mean I have to be a supporting member of any organized religion. I think there will be a burst of energy following this statement. I feel it already.
What are you working on right now?
I'm working on a third novel with a hero, Toby O'Dare, in a series called Songs of the Seraphim. And certainly a great deal of this pain and this agony will go into that novel. There's a new freedom to confess my fears, my doubts, my pain, my conflicts, my alienation that perhaps was not there before. You know, I don't really like disappointing all my Catholic friends. I don't really like disappointing all my Christian friends and contacts. I really don't like it. It's painful. But I did what I felt I had to do.
Anne Rice, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for making time for us.
Thank you.
That's the novelist Anne Rice talking about her announcement last week that she has, in her words, quit being a Christian.
This week, a California man announced to great fanfare that a stack of glass negatives he bought at a garage sale a decade ago for $45 were taken by renowned photographer Ansel Adams, and he said experts had pegged their value as high as $200 million. Now, that didn't go over well with Adams's grandson or his estate. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports on the man who bought the negatives and the resulting swirl of conflicting accounts about who actually took them.
It's an irresistible story. A building painter in Fresno hits the jackpot when he proves, after 10 years of trying, that he struck gold rummaging around at a garage sale.
Ansel Adams originals.
Straight worth out of the Antiques Roadshow.
$200 million.
Bought these pictures at a garage sale for $45.
The man who found the negatives, Rick Norsigian, enlisted a team of photography and handwriting experts to prove his claim. He even got a meteorologist who, looking at one of the negatives, declared the clouds and the snow cover proved it was taken on the same day Ansel Adams took one of his most famous photographs of the iconic Jeffrey Pine Tree in Yosemite. But Matthew Adams, Ansel's grandson, isn't buying it.
I don't believe they've proven the case. And to make a claim that they are authentic and have a value that they're claiming is, to me, is irresponsible.
The managing trustee for the Adams estate is more blunt.
Well, I think they're bosh.
William Turnage is known for playing hardball. He says he's talking to his lawyers.
We own the copyright to Ansel's name. So if they are not Ansel's photographs and they're using his name to sell them, or if they are Ansel's negatives, we can stop them on that ground.
Rick Norsigian says he's tried over the years to work with the Ansel Adams Trust and the family with no luck. Norsigian's got big plans for the negatives. His lawyer, Arnold Peter, helped him launch a website where they'll sell prints for $7,500. Peter says they're planning a documentary and a public exhibition.
We intend to display them as the lost negatives of Ansel Adams, as authenticated by the panel of experts that we have engaged.
But establishing whether these negatives are authentic is anything but black and white. Andy Grunberg chairs the photography department at the Corcoran College of Art and Design. He used to be the director of the Ansel Adams Center for Photography in San Francisco.
It's harder in photography than it is in painting, because
painting, there are experts who examine particular artists' paintings down to the brush stroke, to the kind of pigments that they use. In photography, you have to use more circumstantial evidence.
First of all, let me be very clear. I'm agnostic as to who took the photographs. All I'm doing is printing them.
That's photographer Jesse Kalischer. He's been commissioned by lawyer Arnold Peter to make prints of Norsigian's negatives. Kalischer's work is in some major museums, including the Smithsonian and the Louvre. He says he's already gotten some angry emails from Ansel Adams fans.
They, you know, were titled things like Shame on You and, you know, took me to the woodshed and typically rude terms.
Kalischer is quick to admit that what he produces will not be Ansel Adams' prints. Adams was a master in the darkroom. His art was very much in the printing process.
Regardless of who created the negatives, they deserve to be preserved for history, and they certainly cry out to be printed.
This story has a couple of more twists. As the week went on, there were at least two more claims about who took the photos. One came from an 87-year-old woman from Oakland, California. Miriam Walton told her local TV station they were taken by her Uncle Earl.
And I thought, oh my God, that's exactly the same picture.
Not surprisingly, William Turnage of the Ansel Adams Trust thinks she may be right.
It's more likely they're Uncle Earls than they're Ansels.
Either way, that $45 Rick Norsigian spent at a garage sale is looking like a good investment. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Holly Golightly. Just saying her name makes me feel happy. She was Truman Capote's creation for his 1958 novel, Breakfast at Tiffany's. And in a new book, Fifth Avenue, 5 a.m., Audrey Hepburn, Breakfast at Tiffany's, and the Dawn of the Modern Woman, writer Sam Wasson shows that the film character that Audrey Hepburn created captured the imagination of an America on the cusp of the sexual revolution.
I don't even want to own anything until I can find a place where me and things go together. I'm not sure where that is, but I know what it's like. It's like Tiffany's. The quietness and the proud look of it. Nothing very bad could happen to you there.
The free spirit from Tulip, Texas, for whom life wasn't perhaps carefree, Holly Golightly got men to pay her way in New York City. Paramount knew it was on shaky ground with a woman who used sex in this way. Sam Wasson joins us now. Sam Wasson, glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, let's back up a little bit, because your book does. You actually begin with Truman Capote. This book comes out in 1958, but Capote couldn't even get magazines to serialize this because it was considered too shocking.
One of the things that people forget about Holly in Truman's novel is that she had a bisexual streak. And in fact, the character of the narrator, who George Peppard played in the film, was himself gay. And I'm sure Harper's took a great issue with that. And we know for sure that Paramount had a great deal of difficulty translating that aspect of the novel into a mainstream heterosexual romantic comedy.
Okay, so let's jump from the book to the movie. Writer George Axelrod softens those things, cleans them up, if you will. But Axelrod has a really tough challenge here. He has to develop a romantic interest for Holly, and he does that with George Peppard, who plays Paul Varjak, the man who falls for her,
right.
And her, and the two of them have an unconventional relationship. And how does he soften it from the book? Tell us.
I should go back a bit and say, in a lot of the 50s romantic comedies, Doris Day and Rock Hudson kind of stuff, which I know a lot of people love, but that's not my cup of tea. What's happening is, the conflict is getting these two people married, getting them together. And once they get together, the movie ends. Well, when you're dealing with a call girl, they're already getting together. So what's the conflict that you're going to build into the story to actually make it a feature-length film? Every story needs a conflict. Axelrod came up with the, I think, brilliant idea. And this was, of course, not in Capote's novel. Axelrod's idea was, well, wait a second. If Audrey's playing a call girl and George Peppard is playing a gigolo, that the problem is not a lack of sex. The problem is too much sex, such that they're so tired by the time they actually do get together that they don't get together. And you see that in that scene when Audrey first climbs into bed with George.
Mm-hmm.
They're not sleeping together, but they're two gigolos because it's the end of a long day's work. And George is clever about suggesting all of this. He can't come right out and say they're gigolos, obviously, but the implication is strong. And it's because of that that the movie has the conflict that it has and the legs that it does.
I love the scene where Holly and Paul go to Tiffany's, Holly's place of retreat and imagination, and they are going to get a Cracker Jack ring engraved there. And John McGiver gives this brilliant performance as this very restrained clerk.
That is my absolute favorite scene in the movie, and it's not a scene that people talk about and was, in fact, not in the novel. It was an invention of George Axelrod's. That, for him, was a tribute to the kind of sophisticated romantic comedy that he had always dreamed of writing.
Do they still really have prizes in crackerjack boxes?
Oh, yes.
That's nice to know. It gives one a feeling of solidarity, almost of continuity with the past, that sort of thing.
Do you think Tiffany's would really engrave it for us? I mean, you don't think they would feel it was beneath them or anything like that?
Well, it is rather unusual, madam. But I think you'll find that Tiffany's is very understanding. If you'll tell me what initials you would like, I think we could have something ready for you in the morning.
Didn't I tell you this was a lovely place?
I just love that because it's the most brilliant way of confirming the innocent side of, yeah, of Holly Golightly. You know, she doesn't get punished for her sexuality. I'm thinking, you know, Cleopatra, Scarlett O'Hara, other sirens,
right,
you know, lose their men and,
right,
and therefore, by extension, get punished. She gets her man and she gets away with it.
Yeah, and we love her for it. And she's glamorous. You know, another thing is the Givenchy aspect of this film. And
we can't forget the little black dress.
Yes, yes, that's so important. You know, she's being rewarded for that's what the black is all about. You know, there were not many young women, girls, and that's really what Holly is in this film, who got to wear black in the movies. You think of Debbie Reynolds, for instance, and most women of this era were wearing these cute, young, you know, little cute things with bright colors and mm-hmm. patterns, you know, the poodle skirt aspect of femininity. But yet here's Audrey Hepburn with a slight element of danger coming out of this cab in this sleek, sophisticated black gown. You know, black was reserved for Bette Davis, Gloria Swanson, Joan Crawford, these tough dames who were a little dark. There is a touch of danger, and we love her for it. She makes it okay. Audrey's a girl that you can become.
Sam Wasson. His new book is called Fifth Avenue, 5 a.m. Audrey Hepburn, Breakfast at Tiffany's, and the Dawn of the Modern Woman. Sam Wasson, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And you can read about Truman Capote's mother, Lily May, who was the inspiration for his Holly Golightly character, on our website, npr.org.
The latest installment of our series, 50 Great Voices, features a man who recorded under the name The Notorious B.I.G. People knew him as Biggie Smalls or Biggie. He was murdered when he was 24 years old. Yet he's one of the most revered, emulated, and biggest-selling rappers in the game. Here's NPR's Franny Kelly.
Biggie's voice doesn't sound like anybody else's. It's plummy, wheezy, humid. It sounds like it comes from deeper in his chest than other people's voices.
Tim's for my hooligans in Brooklyn. That's dead right. If they head right, Biggie there and I. Papa been school since days of under rules. Never lose, never choose to. Bruce Cruz who? Do something to us. Talk, go through us.
He learned diction and phrasing from jazz saxophonist Donald Harrison when Biggie was just a teenager in Brooklyn and still went by the name Chris Wallace.
First time I spoke with Chris, Notorious B.I.G., he was on the stoop, and I was passing by, and he just said hello. He was a lot younger, but he wanted to learn about music, and that was magic words to my ears.
Harrison wanted to make his neighbor a jazz musician. He gave him homework, made him learn how to scat a Cannonball Adderley solo, and listen to Charlie Parker and Ella Fitzgerald.
We work on various tonguing and speed and agility so that each note comes out You have to slow things down really slow and take the time to phrase each note.
It was all a dream. I used to read Word Up magazine. Salt and pepper and Heavy D up in the limousine. Hanging pictures on my wall. Every Saturday, Rap Attack, Mr. Magic, Molly Mall.
Biggie started rapping with his friends Sam Hubert and Mike Bynum when they were around 10 or 11 years old. Hubert met Chris in daycare. He became Big's DJ.
We tried to go to studio at the age of, I believe, 13. My man Mike's dad dropped us off. It was crazy. You know, people don't know that he really did take it serious at a young age, really being focused on getting as good as you could. You know, so all of these things were part of Chris's early development, you know, when he was MC Quest, you know, and it was like he was on a quest to become the greatest of all time.
Hubert says even after all that hard work, and despite his obvious talent, Big lost focus for a while.
He was on course to just be a brilliant student, college grad, possible doctor, lawyer, whatever. I mean, but the pull of the streets, it grabbed him. By 16, he was already gone, neck deep in it. So him and his mom had a big fallout because he basically stepped off the path. She was a teacher. She wanted him to, of course, go to school. What are you going to do, go out to the corner every day and bring him in the house by his ear? It's not going to happen.
Big dropped out of high school after his freshman year. He reportedly began selling drugs, but he kept practicing. Here he is at 17, freestyling on the street in Brooklyn. A local DJ named 50 Grand made a mixtape for Big that ended up in the Source magazine's Unsigned Hype column. Puff Daddy heard it and eventually signed Big to a deal. By 1993, he had a song in the movie Who's the Man?
Hugs from the honeys, pound from the rough neck. See my man saying that I knew from the project. Said he had beef, asked me if I had my piece. Sure do, 222s in my shoes. Holla if you need me, love, I'm in the house. Roman stroke, see what the honeys is about.
With wit and presence like that, Biggie put other rappers on notice. But what he had more than anything else was flow. That's how rappers pace the voicing of their lyrics. They choose a rhythmic pattern to match each beat. Rapper AZ, not Jay-Z, met Biggie when Big was rapping on street corners. He describes flow this way.
Flow is like water. It's like current. The fluidity of your words and how you can slow it up, pick it up, chop it up. Because it's the structure of the words. It's flow is a beautiful thing.
AZ says you can hear that on a song called Warning.
Who the f*** is this? Page me at 5:46 in the morning, crack of dawning, now I'm yawning, wipe the cold out my eye, see who's this page of me, and why, it's my pop from the barbershop, told me he was in the gambling spot, and heard the intricate plot.
I don't care where, what part of the earth you from, when you listen to it, the dialogue is slow enough for you to digest it. He give you a descriptive image of what's going on in your head, and when you actually tell a story and being descriptive, that takes talent.
They heard about the pounds that got down in Georgetown, and they heard they got half Virginia locked down. They even heard about the clip that brought your mom from Florida, the fifth corridor, called the coroner. It's gonna be a lot of slow singing and flower bringing if my burglar alarm starts ringing.
Biggie so impressed his peers in the mid-90s that almost every New York rapper has recorded a song that includes a shout-out to him.
Brooklyn, New York City, where they paint murals of Biggie.
Right here, Big. Your boy sitting on top like a hair wig. Bed-Stuy, fly, Bushwick, sick.
Flow infinitely like the memory of my nigga Biggie. Baby.
Who shot Biggie Smalls? If we don't get them, they gon' get us all.
The greatest rapper of all time died on March 9th. God bless his soul. Rest in peace, kid. It's because of him.
Big influenced a generation. This whole generation took pieces and bits of... Everybody took a piece out of Big that's on the charts right now. Everybody.
And he only released 2 albums. On some of his songs, Big tells true stories. But on some of them, he spins the kind of Homeric tales of street lore that you can hear in a lot of rap. There's violence, guns, drugs.
The Chris I knew was a good guy.
Donald Harrison.
He wasn't the guy who did all these things. He was really looking for love and acceptance at the end of the day. That's what he was looking for. And he paid the price for looking for love.
Biggie was shot to death on March 9th, 1997, only 6 months after Tupac Shakur was murdered. The two rappers had been friends, and there's a lot of speculation that their killings were connected. Big's friends still have a hard time talking about the music he made. After all, in a way, their friend lost his life because of rap.
I can't wear a Biggie t-shirt. You know that, right? That's not... The pain is deeper than just, you know, it's just what you could even imagine. It's not on the surface, you know, so...
Sam Hubert says if Big had lived, the rap game would be very different today. He was so young, just starting to push the boundaries of his genre and starting to tell stories about people whose voices don't get heard. As AZ says, at the end of the day, rapping is about bringing people into your world. That's what Big used his voice for. Frannie Kelly, NPR News.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.